This is the ninth reel of a tape interview with Norman Digby in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 5th of the 12th, 2001, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Norman, you were talking about the particular instance of a chap wanting a shotgun. Can you tell us the finish of that story?
Having decided the manner in which we would transport this double-barrel shotgun, that is, have it concealed in the Bren gun box the box was quite a large size, sufficient enough to for a Bren gun to be securely and some magazines, but it was also there was enough room to be able to dismantle the shotgun and slip it down alongside the Bren gun. Now that was the method intended to get it back to the Labune camp. So I should imagine, and not that I had anything to do with it, how it got back to Australia, but I assume that in its broken down condition would have been placed in his kit bag and surrounded by clothing and personal effects. So as far as I was aware, because I left Labion before he was demobbed, so I haven't seen the fellow since that day, so I assume that he's got it home safely. And like a lot of other things, I myself brought a samurai sword back in the kit bag, but I was told by a specialist Japanese fellow after the war who was collecting samurai swords for to return to their original owners, of course they're purchasing them, that it had been cut down. I couldn't hardly imagine, because the scabbard hadn't been mutilated in any way. Of course, I think it was probably a bit of sales talk. But,
we spoke about the sort of spoils of war earlier on when you were in the desert. To what extent was there a sort of turning a blind eye to all of this sort of thing, do you think?
Oh, I think it was a bit dangerous. I mean, if you knew, being in command, and I'm referring generally to the officers and rank above, they'd have to be very careful that there was no indication expressed that they knew that you were carrying illegal weapons or something of that nature. But of course we were continually advised about bringing back enemy weapons or any illegal weapons into Australia, so much to that extent that with my Luger though I might have mentioned it before, I could have sold it to the Americans for quite a considerable sum of money, but eventually I sold it to an Air Force fellow for £14 or something of that nature. So I didn't want to get caught up in any customs or police or anyone of that nature, so that was the end of the Luger.
So what was then to happen once you left this particular ship?
Well, we brought the people from Tawaiyo to Jesselton, and then I don't think we went back to Labuan. We then went to Sandakan or Sandakan, and just for the express purpose of bringing back war criminals involved in the death march in the Sandakan. There was not very many people involved in, I'd only be guessing if I said 50, but it wasn't in the same content as the people that we brought, or numerically content of those that we brought back from Tawaiyo. So they we were briefed in no way were we to give them any indication that they were suspected of being Kempi Kai and those responsible for the the deaths and the murdering of the Allied forces, that's the Brits and the Australians.
What did you know about this particular situation?
Well, we only knew about the considerable deaths that were involved in the marches and the ill treatment, and any further description of it would be from hindsight information. But at the time, they were responsible for the deaths and the ill treatment to those that were involved as prisoners of war in that area.
So what had you actually heard in relation to, you know, how they treated people and what had actually gone on?
Well, we'd heard a fair bit in regards to what went on in Singapore and other places, or from may even been from what how the locals were treated when we were in working in the western area. That's the area that we were mainly associated with, and though we hadn't actually been involved with any of the repatriated planters at that particular time, though we later on we were associated with them. But at the time we collected the group from Sandakan, we just classify them as ruthless and butchers and that. But
how did they react to the situation that, you know, the Japanese had surrendered, the war was over for them? How were they reacting to the situation?
Well, with them, it wasn't over surveillance on them. They were just treated as ordinary prisoners of war, and no undue treatment to them. They were just treated as just the same as the previous people that we've been involved with the whole intention is that we did not want to give them the impression that they were the Kempi Kai and responsible for their actions.
But how were they reacting to the general situation of the fact that the Japanese had surrendered?
Well, from memory, peaceful is not the right word, but I mean they didn't seem to be disturbed, and we didn't go out of our way to let them think otherwise. And when we eventually came to Jesselton to hand them over to the authorities there, we had to be very, very careful how we were handling them, and also to make sure that there were no interference with them by our own troops that were in the Jesselton area.
Do you think they had an idea of what was being done?
I think they would realise that sort of the numbers that were involved in it, that they were being treated specially, because there would have been other people, there were other people, other Japanese people left at Sandakan after we brought these people back, and they were handled by other members of the regiment, but I didn't have much to do with that part of it. So they would realise, hindsight wise, that they were a bit different to those that their own troops that were left behind.
What was the general feeling of those people, you know, having to guard them and having to sort of treat them with these kid gloves? Given the opportunity, what do you think would have been the real response?
Well, I can give you an example, though I don't think I saw it happen, but apparently when we arrived at Jesselton, we sort of doubled our guards in around the bow of the LST because of the ramp slipped down, and they would be disembarked down through the ramps, all picked up by vehicles driven in. I'm not sure what really happened about that, but the story went was that one of the infantrymen or some Australian on the forces that were in Jesselton at the time got through the guard system somehow or other, and he was going to play Mary Hill with them because his brother was one of those that had been killed in the march, the death march. But fortunately, he never got to that stage. So that was the... I mean, if they'd been let out, they wouldn't have got too far from the infantry troops that were involved in the area. Or not only the infantry, but in the case of somebody's near relative was involved in the march, you never know what would happen next. So that was the situation which I would have imagined if they were just freely walked off the boat, they wouldn't have got too far.
What was their attitude towards the people that were guarding them? Did they have any sort of humility about the situation?
No, I don't think so. There was no sort of pilfering or anything that they had they brought with them, though it was a bit tempting, I should imagine.
People talk of when they've been captured, this sort of guilt and sort of letting down the side feeling. And I was interested to know whether you may have noticed.
Yeah, well, of course, the other thing was that they're dead scared that if they were aware and demonstrated to them that they were war criminals and belonged to this Kempe Kai group, which is the equivalent of the SS troops of Germany, they may have committed suicide, and that would mean a loss of information in the war crimes tribunals and judgment day on what really did happen. So that was one thing that we had to be a bit careful about, and as I said, not let them realise that we knew who they were or what they had done. So I should imagine if they'd be fairly, not peaceful in mind, but in their physical expressions, and that they'd be a bit careful of what they did or wouldn't adopt an aggressiveness like some of the prisoners, particularly Prussians and things of that nature, were a bit aggressive. I mean, I suppose you'll run into those in any nationality, but I don't think I ever saw any expressions of that nature.
Was it from here that you would then be sent home to Australia?
No, well, from Jesselton we went back to to Labuan, and by that time, as I've mentioned previously about the demobilisation of the 5 years, and well, it was virtually a skeleton force left there, and reading through historical data, the regiment basically became the administrative centre, and other troops from other units were amalgamated in and were under the control of our senior officers.
You wanted to mention a story before we go on too much further, right, about the collection of dead bodies. Could you
something passed through my mind was in the Brunei incident, in the early part of the Brunei incident, and I'm only referring to our unit's early part, because the infantry from the 24th Brigade had moved from the village or compound at Western, that was on the coast, moved along the railway track towards Beaufort, and we came in later on when most things were quiet, and we took up positions close by on a rising ground above a swamp, which I don't know whether it's a tidal one or otherwise, but apparently, I'm not too sure which battalion it was, that there were about six fellows killed in the early movements towards Beaufort. After things quietened down, they were buried alongside the railway track and just below the rising ground, and it was hastily done sort of business. They had to be buried, and so what actually happened, I don't know where they got the planks that they had the bodies on, individual planks wrapped in a blanket, buried, and they cross in his name and his number, and that's how we first saw them. So, one day I was up in our area, and a fellow came who later on, I found out that he advised me that he was from the War Graves Commission, and apparently his task was to retrieve these bodies and have them taken over to Labuan and for the war cemetery that was going to be created over there or was underway. He's only on his by himself, so he collected quite a number of the locals from the village, and on the jeep train they travelled to this particular spot. And once they realised what the job was, they were gone in a flash, and he was left there by himself to retrieve the bodies. And he must have known that we were somewhere in the vicinity, so that's when he made contact with me, and he said he wondered if anybody would come and give him a hand and volunteer to do it. So a few were asked about this situation, and weren't any volunteers. So I volunteered, and another one of the chaps that was pretty close to me said, "I'll come too." So I think there was only the two of us. So away we went down to the railway track, and we didn't have the slightest idea how to go about it. And out came the big coffin boxes or whatever, boxes of some description. And the first one, he looked up to the chap's name, let's say it was Bill somebody, and he's talking to Bill, and of course the only thing that they could do was, because it's submerged in water and mud and things of that nature, and the bodies are decomposed, and because there's the skeletons, so basically, and there's no way we're going to collect up a complete skeleton, put it in the box. And so anyway, it was a matter of picking up essential bones and sorting them out and making sure they belong to Bill. And so this went on from Bill to Tom, Barry, Dick, and so on like this. It wasn't very pleasant that that had to be done. So when it was finished, the box was sealed up, and I invited him up to, because it was around about lunchtime or something like that, to come up and wash up and have something to eat. And so as we start to move up towards the lunch area, which was a matter of sitting on a log here and there sort of business, soon as we start to move amongst these, the rest of our troops, I didn't want to be involved with anybody that was fiddling around with dead bodies. And in other words, one got the impression that we stunk. So we eventually, after a bit of cleaning up, we had our lunch, and that was the end of that little situation. But I do think that we did get a note from the Wargraves thanking us for what we had done. So that's that situation.
Before we move on, I was wondering what the general thought was when you were doing this rather gruesome job, as relation to the fact that you were one of the lucky ones that had made it through without being in that situation.
Well, of course, previously I'd mentioned that, I think I've mentioned before, that I had helped bury fellows in the Alamein situation. That's buried them in the cemeteries. That was a different sort of a situation. And what with having a padre there and the proper ceremonies and things like that, and it was a task that had to be done. It wasn't really a nasty thing, except that one had lost his life. But the western area one was a pretty gruesome sort of a situation. I mean, I suppose every now and again you'd feel something, you know, upchuck or something of that nature, but you know, you just sort of carried on about it, and
Did you have any attitude towards, you know, where is God in all this sort of situation? How does it choose between who makes it and who doesn't?
No. The only thing that we sort of worked on was that if your name was on the bullet, there's not much you can do about it. And apparently their numbers were on the bullet, so that's the way the cookie crumbles sort of business. But you know, if you start to worry about back into families and the effects on their families and things like that, well, you know, you could get yourself upset a bit, but you've got to remember that we've been through five years of it, so...
I'm interested to sort of discuss the, you know, the sort of philosophy that a soldier adopts in relation
well,
to that sort of situation.
When I came home, and bit of, you know, blood around the place didn't have any effect on me during those particular years. A few incidents, you know, after the war, I've been, you know, someone has in the house, a bit of blood's lost in that, and I've just about collapsed, and I've had to sit down and do those things, or even if I've been in the hospital, or going to see someone, or one in the case with a bit of blood involved in the situation, I think the medicos have been watching me more than so that's the difference of. But, you know, when you've been totally involved in the situation and accustomed to it, and then you come back to normal and you go back to what you were before. I mean, like people that I know in the early part of my military life in the militia, and that I've seen blokes collapse before they've had an inoculation, they needles and things like that. I mean, you've probably heard that story 100 times, but that's just the make-up of the person concerned.
Well, maybe we should talk then about you coming home and, you know, your war experience over and done with.
Well,
tell us about the process of coming home.
Well, after all the ceremonies, surrender ceremonies, because we had quite a lot to do, when I say we, the regiment, the coaching and there were rumours going around all around the place that we're going to do this and do that, and surrender parties that some were done and some weren't done and things like that. And then there was the bringing back of the the planters, and then the planters would I can remember the planters coming back to see their estates and things like that, and the whole of those that were left of the locals coming down to the wherever the train stopped alongside the plantation homes and things, because the Japs used the plantation homes. We were involved with them, though, you know, they came purely back to see the their own staff and their some of their own kids and things like that. Because at least they, there's one thing about them, they, you know, if they had any illegitimate kids and that, they were always reasonably well educated, though they weren't sent to the posh schools or anything like that, they're probably convents and things of that nature. So if they knew that he didn't come back to the station or to the plantation and he was still alive there, they were very, very disappointed. And I happened to be at one plantation there. So those were the situations. And then